Welcome, Red Eyes members. Thank you very much for joining us here for our second hour. We are talking with Dennis Price, and we've been discussing his book, The Missing Years of Jesus. And we do want to get into some of the background here, obviously, and I want to ask Dennis a little bit later if there's any connection between Stonehenge and the missing years of Jesus, and see if there's any parallels in regards to that. But obviously, to get us started here, Dennis, and to get into the topic of Stonehenge, maybe you can just share with us when you first saw, or when you first became aware of Stonehenge, and why you did indeed become interested in it.
Well, it's a long time ago, Henrik, but I can remember it as if it was yesterday. My mother and father took me to Stonehenge in 1969 with myself and my sister. And these were in the years when people could just freely wander around the place. Obviously, it was in the same year that men first walked on the moon. But I remember that really well, being taken there when I was a child. And I was just, I can close my eyes and I go back there. I was just absolutely enchanted with the place. I just thought it was the most wonderful thing you could imagine. I didn't have the faintest idea what it was for or what it was or anything like that, but that's how it started off. So, you know, as the years went by, I naturally read about it as much as I could. And then to cut, you know, a long story short, in 1996, I moved away from London, and my family and I went to live on Salisbury Plain. And we lived in a village not far from Stonehenge, which meant that because I was a local resident, I could get a free pass to the place. So, 1996, after some years had gone by, I saw it again, and I went there, I suppose, for about 10 years I lived on Salisbury Plain. I went to Stonehenge about three or four times a week, which I think makes me the person who's visited it most. I mean, that's not a boast or anything, it was just an accident of geography, but my children learned to walk there, and I would push them around in their pushchairs, and it was wonderful. They would have their ice cream, and I would just walk and walk around Stonehenge looking at it. And even though I'd read a lot about it beforehand, like everyone else, I looked at the place, and all I saw were huge rocks put together in a strange fashion, and I didn't have the faintest idea what it was or what it was about. But I kept on visiting the place. I kept reading about it. There's a huge book called Stonehenge in its Landscape. Only 500 copies were ever printed. It's got something like 618 pages with hundreds of diagrams, and it was the collection of all the excavations that had taken place at Stonehenge over the last 100 years. So I sat down, I read that, I think, about four times, although it's, you know, just about impossible to take it all in. And there are custodians at Stonehenge as well, the people that work for English Heritage. I always made a point, whenever I went there, of speaking to these people and just asking them what they thought about it, or asking them if they had spotted anything that they thought was interesting. Mm. So that's how I pretty much, you know, got the ball rolling with the place.
Considering your background in archaeology, have you done any excavations or other archaeological work at the site yourself?
I would. There's an organization called the Stonehenge Riverside Project, run by Professor Mike Parker Pearson, and they've been digging there every year for about the last 5 or 6 years. So I have dug with them. I dug at the end of the Cursus, which is the big, huge earthworks north of Stonehenge. I've worked there, and there have been endless plans to build a bypass, get rid of the roads and all that kind of thing. So I've dug on the test pit project around Stonehenge, mm. and I've visited the excavations as often as I can, yes.
So what are you guys looking for if we talk about, you know, the work that the organization you mentioned have been doing? What is the primary thing that you're looking for?
Well, you would have to divide it into them and myself. I'm not part of the Stonehenge Riverside Project, but I'm, you know, on the best possible terms with them. I follow their work very carefully. on World Heritage sites and such like.
Yes.
The Stonehenge Riverside Project dig at very selected sites every year where they think there may be something interesting, and they dig as best they can. They're not rushed. They dig for about a month or 6 weeks and such like, and they make a superb job of it, which I have to say is in great contrast to a lot of the excavations that have taken place over Stonehenge over the years.
Mm.
But I pursue a different path myself, and of course I'll be happy to tell you about the things that I've looked into.
Absolutely. Where do you want to begin, so to speak? I mean, we could, I guess, talk about some of the general ideas about the background first and what you've found in regards to that, you know, who built it, how, and when. I guess that those are the primary questions that we need to get off the table first, so to speak.
Okay, well, I suppose when I looked at Stonehenge first, just like everyone else, when they look at it, you can't make head or tail of it. And, you know, there are plenty of good books on the subject, and there's a lot about it, especially on Wikipedia, that gives you a good outline of it. And to put it in its simplest possible way, the first thing that we know of on the site of Stonehenge was a circular ditch and a bank that was dug just before 3000 BC, something like that. And it had at least two causeways going into it, one causeway from the south and the other from the northeast. And one of the strange things about Stonehenge is it has an external... An external ditch to it,
mm-hmm.
You see. So an internal bank, which means that it was probably about 6 feet high at the time, and it stops people from seeing inside. If you have an external bank, then people can stand on it and gaze across the ditch. But Stonehenge was unusual. There was a ditch on the outside and a bank on the inside, which meant that from the very, very first beginnings of it, it's pretty obvious that people weren't supposed to see what was taking place inside. Now, we know from a number of excavations that one of the main things that happened in the early years of Stonehenge was that a great many people were buried there. We've found the remains of at least 240 of them so far. And without going into detail, we can be pretty sure that these people were royal, that it was some kind of dynasty, that bones have been examined. And there are very few of the older ones, but as time goes on, they become more and more. So it suggests that some royal family or dynasty was first laid to rest at Stonehenge. And I should point out that a lot of these bones were dug up in the early part of the last century in an official capacity, but they were of no interest to the scientists at the time. So they were kept in a shed, and they were eventually dumped in one of the holes at Stonehenge in 1935. And just last year, they were dug up again. And one of the many, many issues surrounding Stonehenge at the moment is the reburial issue, because a lot of people feel that these human remains of the earliest people, the earliest kings that built the place, it's all very well to examine them, but that they ought to be returned. It's a bit like having the Vatican without the bones of the saints and such like.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I just searched a little bit here on our own site, Red Eyes, and found actually a little bit of information about Stonehenge and one of the theories then, of course, and this is actually an interview in some parts of this article contains the interview with the Professor Julian Thompson, the co-director of the Stonehenge Riverside Project, and where he talks a little bit about this idea of it being basically a massive funeral complex. Do you agree with this? Is this also what you've found?
Well, it's hard to argue with it, because if you found the remains of at least 240 people at Stonehenge itself, and if it's surrounded by funeral mounds and such like, then, you know, there were all obviously a great, great many dead people there. So it's difficult, you know, to argue with that, you see. But I suppose if you're really going to look into it in detail, you have to ask yourself, I think, you know, what, not only what function Stonehenge served, but if it could have served a number at the same time.
So, yeah, yeah.
It might have been a funerary place, and of course all the evidence points towards that, but it might be a bit more complicated than that. I mean, just to resume this outline of the place, in general terms, it seems that around 3000 BC, you know, a great many people were buried there. And then it seems, again, that the place was deserted for a couple of hundred years. Mm-hmm. And we have evidence then of a timber structure of some kind inside the ditch. But it's very difficult to reconstruct it because the foundations are shallow. And it's been dug into so many times over the centuries, and it was dug into so many times when the site was in active use because people were putting stones there, taking them up, rearranging them, putting others in and such like. But we're pretty sure that there was some kind of timber structure there. And then later on, the most famous example that people recognize as Stonehenge came when the huge uprights and the circle of lintels was built. That was around 2300 BC. Mm-hmm. Although the picture is getting more complicated these days with the different excavations that have taken place there, because some people now seem to think that there was a huge circle of bluestones there, 56 bluestones, in the earliest phase of Stonehenge, which was 3000 BC. Mm. This circle of Aubrey holes, called after the person that discovered them, 56 of them in a circle inside the ditch, and nobody knew what they were for. We found cremated remains inside them, but now they've been dug up again carefully, or one of them has. It looks as if a stone did once stand there. So the picture changes all the time. It looks as if there's a ditch and a bank dug there with causeways, but right at its earliest phase, there may have been 56 stones there, which were later removed for some reason we don't know about. Then there was a timber phase, and then the most famous one of the lot, when the blue stones were put in the middle of Stonehenge and when the huge Sarsen circle was erected around it. And then it comes to about 1600 BC. It's always amused me when I've read the official accounts of it, where they say that Stonehenge apparently fell into disuse. No one has any explanation for why this vast, sophisticated monument with so many people buried there that was clearly the center of the known world at the time, why almost overnight it fell into disuse. But we know, again, from recent excavations that the avenue that links Stonehenge with the river, that even though Stonehenge apparently wasn't being used, that people as late as 1000 BC, and that's getting very close to the time of the Druids and such like,
yes,
they rebuilt a big part of the avenue. So that's pretty much it.
And so, go ahead.
No, that's pretty much it. There's a huge amount more to the subject, of course, but that's the general picture that people have. I should obviously mention, I don't know if people have heard about Bluestonehenge, which was the most recent discovery made this year.
That's right. Just actually going to ask you about that, because you mentioned the bluestones inside, but now they've found another one close to the River Avon, I think it's called, right?
That's right, the River Avon, yes.
Avon,
it's amazing.
Avon, yeah.
Yeah, they dug there last year. The Stonehenge Riverside Project, and they found what they thought at the time might have been a funeral barrow, but they dug it again this year. And it's just astonishing. It looks as if before Stonehenge existed, that the people at the time built a bluestone circle down there. Then they very carefully, it stood for a couple of hundred years apparently, and then they very carefully dismantled it and buried it. And so the obvious implication is that these bluestones were taken further up the road to Stonehenge.
Yes, yes.
And then again, in the late Bronze Age, you know, perilously close to the time of the Druids, 2,000 years later, these people dug this place up again. They must have had a memory from 2,000 years back of it being a site of some importance.
But I mean, that's so weird, because we hear this about other sites around the world as well. We have legends about one people building an incredible site. This is in South America, it's in Syria, there's in Egypt, other places as well, where The site is used for a while, then something happens. For whatever reason, the civilization or culture there seem to maybe not collapse. They might move for climactic reasons or whatever, or you know, the climate change occurs. You have waxing and waning, so to speak, of ice ages coming and going, cold, whatever.
Yeah.
It becomes inactive, and then another people come there again and dig it up or and use it for another purpose, so to speak. But if we look at the original builders of the site, any theories in regards to that? Who were they, and what were they using it for, if we look at that first?
The people who built Blue Stonehenge, you mean?
Stonehenge. We can actually start with Blue Stonehenge, then, if it seems to point to the fact that that's earlier than Stonehenge.
Well, it's pretty certain it's earlier, but it's sort of still early days about it. I can't really speak with great authority about it, and I'll tell you why. It's because the excavations took place over the summer, and you know, I heard a great deal about them, and the people that dug there, as I say, Professor Mike Parker Pearson and the Stonehenge Riverside Project, they were hoping to release their material in January, but one of the British newspapers leaked it in advance, and just spoiled everything for them, I suppose, by putting out just a brief account of it. So if anyone's interested, on my site is the official press release, because after the story was leaked, Mike Parker Pearson, the guy who runs this dig, he sent me a full press release with all the details on there of his thoughts and ideas about it. So, you know, I don't wish to plug my site, but the very, very latest material and thinking and photographs is all on Eternal Idol. If someone wants to go and have a look at it, there's a lot there, and I haven't been able to digest it all myself, which is why, you know, I can't tell you much about it, because if I did, I'd be expressing an opinion that was not a considered one. But it's all up on my site if anyone wishes to read it.
Mm, interesting. Okay, so what about if we go forward in time then and talk about some of the people who maybe did their own additions to it? I know that they've, for instance, found what they call Stonehenge builders' houses and so forth around the area. Does that give away anything of who the people were who were living at that time in the region?
Well, again, this was the Stonehenge Riverside Project that dug there. It was in a place called Durrington Walls, and it's this absolutely huge earthwork just to the northeast of Stonehenge. It's so big that I used to drive through it every day on the way to work when I first lived there, and I never saw it. And I knew that Durrington Walls was around there, and one day I asked a friend of mine where the place was, and he just laughed and pointed to what looked like a hill in a field, and it was so big I didn't see it. Absolutely enormous. You have to stand in the place yourself to comprehend it, although there is a lot of information about it on the internet. But they've only dug at one, you know, it's so huge that only a small part of it has been excavated, but they found a great deal from it. Mm. It looks as if people gathered there at midwinter to go to Stonehenge. They've worked that out from a kind of wood that was being burned there from the animal remains and such like. And so that's one of the theories, is that they were midwinter feasts at Stonehenge, and that the winter time was far more important than the summer. And that, I have to say, is particularly interesting, because last year some people dug at Stonehenge itself. Professors Darble and Wainwright had permission to dig there, and it was the first time anyone had excavated in Stonehenge itself for about 40 years. They came up with a huge amount of material, and something that absolutely fascinated me was that they found charcoal remains, I think it was of holly, ivy, and yew. And when they dated them, far from Stonehenge being an abandoned ruin, the information that I've had suggests that Stonehenge was in active use as late as the 17th century.
Yes.
In midwinter.
Mm-hmm.
So God only knows what was going on there, or who was doing what, but a group of people, or persons, or an individual, something was happening at Stonehenge long after it had thought to be been abandoned, and this was as late as the 17th century. Absolutely mind-numbing. So again, we return to the subject of the Druids, because for a lot of archaeologists, it's an article of faith. They had nothing to do with it. But you know, if the place was being used for so long afterwards, then it suggests that the people of the time did use it, you see.
Could it be that people during that time, 16th century and so forth, and obviously earlier then, would simply were part of carrying on the tradition that has maybe existed at the site for a long time?
Well, it would seem so. We don't have any records of anyone using it, but this is, I mean, everything about Stonehenge interests me, but the aura of the devil hangs over Stonehenge. In the 17th century, it was described as Beelzebub's shrine, and like a lot of these old places, the devil was supposed to have had a hand in it as well. But, you know, it's fascinating stuff. If there had been a Christian tradition that late at the place, then people would have written about it. But we don't know of anything of that kind. But we do know that as late as the 17th century, something was going on there at midwinter. And we know that something was going on there at midwinter in 2600 BC. So it's hard to ignore the coincidence of it, you see.
You mentioned before in the first segment the satanic meals that Blake wrote about. Is that a connection with Stonehenge, do you think, then? Or?
Well, yes, I certainly think it is. I mean, William Blake wrote a lot about the devil and Satan and such like, and he visited Stonehenge as well, and he wrote about it. And he didn't like the place one little bit. He described it as a place of eternal despair and such like. And, you know, in the work I've done, I found a lot of references to the place being built by the devil, which admittedly isn't unusual, but there's another strange part just up the road from Stonehenge, on the main road that goes past it, is a place called the Devil's Batch, which I think refers to some of the funeral mounds there. And again, it's one of those things that you have to decide, is it relevant or is it not? But
and do you think it is?
Well, what I was going to say is that not many years go by without a number of people being killed within sight of Stonehenge. It's a notorious accident black spot there. And I don't keep count of it. I mean, the British Highways Commission would have a record of it. But I just pointed out, for what it's worth, that it's the only place of its kind that I know of where humans regularly die within sight of the place. I mean, you can ascribe it almost certainly to the bad roads and such like, but it's a strange thing. And I should add, while I'm on this subject, is that something else, I've written about it on my site, but I'm sure that very, very few people will be aware of it. But animals are found dead at Stonehenge on a fairly regular basis. And I've never been able to find any satisfactory explanation for that. The custodians and the security staff at Stonehenge regularly, you know, they stay there all night when people aren't allowed to go there, and they regularly find the bodies of foxes, badgers, hares and such like that have died inside the stone circle. And I don't know why that is.
That is interesting. I mean, could it be satanic rituals that are taking place there? And if so, if you believe that is the case, are we talking about a, I guess, less organized, let's say, like a teenage group or whatever, that do the little ritual?
No, that isn't happening, Henrik. It's because the place has security there, and the security at Stonehenge have night visors and night goggles. You know, you can't... Lots of people try it. They try to get over the fences at night, but the security at Stonehenge is first class, even at night. They catch everyone. So no one's ever been caught, you know, performing any ceremonies there. But that's what makes it even more strange for me, is that these small creatures are regularly found dead there. And no one knows why. Or if they do know why, they're not saying.
Well, okay. Well, I don't know how far you want to go here in terms of this, but I mean, there are people out there who do research on the more bigger conspiracy in regards to satanic rituals, and that there actually is an organized group with influential people involved in it and so forth. Do you want to go there? Have you any theories about that?
No, not really. I mean, I'm aware of these things, but you know, as far as Stonehenge is concerned, I think that any association with the devil was a matter of, you know, the beliefs that people held in centuries past. It's just that these creatures that are found dead there, it's not due to a human agency, because people just don't go there at night. They're not allowed to. It's impossible. You know, the guards are very good. And I cannot, you know, I'm a countryman myself. I was brought up in the countryside. I live here now as well. And it's not something I've been able to get anyone to look into or find out about. But I just say that it's a fact that on a regular basis, creatures are found dead inside the ruins, whether they go there to die or whether something causes them to die when they go inside, I don't know. But I just mention it for what it's worth. It's a little known aspect of the place, and one that I've not been able to get anyone to look into.
That's interesting, though, and it could be that it's many people do research on the energetic properties of the site. It could be a vortex point and so forth, which could potentially mean that, just as you say, animals actually go in there for whatever reason, they're drawn there, or whatever, to actually end their life there for some reason.
Well, the strange thing is that I've heard lots of reports of them going there during the day, voluntarily, quite happily. They, they have a sheep nearby, which I don't think get into the ruins, but, you know, I've had people photographing hedgehogs going into Stonehenge by day. I think deer have been seen in there, and most certainly rabbits and hares, they go for the place. I can't think of any reason why they should, because the field that the stones stand in, there's nothing to hunt them. So during the day, they seem to go there voluntarily, quite happily, and it's just that sometimes in the morning, people find the remains of creatures that have died there. I mean, I found one myself when I was there in 2007. Mm-hmm. It was a young hare. I'm not a vet, but the creature had no injury on it. It didn't seem to be diseased. It just died. Mm-hmm. And I was there on a nighttime visit, which ended around 9 o'clock. So when I found it, it must have died at some point before then and not been seen during the day. But there's another aspect of Stonehenge, which I've mentioned on my site, and I felt it was relevant to mention in my book about the missing years of Jesus, is that Stonehenge has another strange property, and it was described to me by some of the people that work there, and I experienced it for myself as well. And it's very difficult to describe, but it was told to me that it was as if on certain nights the stones draw down starlight. And to be precise about this, if it's a moonless night and you're standing at Stonehenge looking out into the darkness, it's possible to see people approaching the ruins before they see you. Mm-hmm. Now, there are all manner of possible explanations for this, but it's as if, that's how it's been described to me, it's as if the place sometimes draws down the starlight. If you're standing there looking out and it's in the dark, then somehow you have the ability to see someone walking up to it before they see you. Now, I know that you could say, well, that's because you're standing against stones and such like, but on a nighttime visit I had when I went there some years ago, it was the same thing. I saw a security guard approaching long before he saw me. So whatever the explanation for it, whether it's a normal one or a natural one or not, it doesn't matter, because it fascinates me that this is how the place may have been perceived in years gone by, that people might not have had an explanation that we're able to provide these days to do with light and optics and such like. If they thought it was a place that drew down starlight, it would have added to the mystique and aura of the place. But there's certainly a lot more to it than just what appears in the guidebooks.
That is interesting. This site holds the aura of the devil, you mentioned before. Do you think that that could be the Christian interpretation to, for whatever reason, demonize the site to keep people away from there and like focus on the church and go to our religious sites and our places instead of going to these old, quotes, pagan places? Or what do you think that means?
Well, as I said, you know, a lot of these old stone circles have these legends. The devil built them or was stopped from building them and such like. So Stonehenge isn't unusual in that respect, although, you know, it's a detailed subject. I've gone into it in my book that there was something particular about it in the 16th and 17th centuries. People did have this idea that it was connected with Beelzebub and with the devil, and it seems to go a bit beyond the normal tales that were told at the time. But, you know, then again, it's such a unique and strange place. There's nothing like it in the world, so it's hardly surprising that that should happen. But again, as I should point it out, that just to the east of Stonehenge is this place called the Devil's Batch, and there aren't many years that go by without humans being killed within sight of Stonehenge at a place, you know, associated with the devil. I'm sure it's just poor roads, but, you know, it's just something worth mentioning, I feel.
If it's a, if it was rather than a burial site, and if animals even go into to die there, so to speak, could it be that it's the place is in some way haunted? It attracts those people who are meant to die, if you know what I mean? It's more esoterically, you know?
Well, I've looked into Stonehenge as carefully as I possibly can over the last 15 years or so, and there certainly do exist accounts of people having seen ghosts and hauntings at Stonehenge, which again is not something that makes, you know, the usual press. It's not something you see in the guidebooks, but I definitely have accounts of those things having taken place. So, to my mind, if they can be seen in our modern era, when there are two huge main roads really close to the place, then it's not hard to imagine that in centuries gone by, without electric lighting and without juggernauts and without roads and such like, that the place would have had a really baleful atmosphere.
And the roads you mentioned there as well, I've heard that there's been construction going on, and there's even been people who protested over the fact that they built one of the roads so close to the area. Do you think that's bad, or is there another reason for that?
This was something that happened, you know, in the last century. They, you know, they just built a road within a couple of a smaller road is within a couple of yards of Stonehenge, and the bigger one is within 100 yards or so. But it's just another aspect of the huge picture of the site, that you have a World Heritage site, and by any standards, you know, if you start to look at Stonehenge, it really is a wonder of the world, and it's just got two huge main roads really close to it. It's, you know, it's been a subject of argument for years and years and years about the planning and such like, but it never seems to come to anything.
If we look at some of the Egyptian lore and so forth in regards to how the dead travel to the stars and so forth, and with you putting forth the idea that this is a burial site for kings at the time or royals at the time, you know, could it be this connection again, the star connection of the royal dynasty, so to speak, of the area, leaving, taking off into the heavens again, or what?
Well, since you mentioned that, Henrik, yes, I couldn't be more interested in this. Yes, I mean, I have a huge book in front of me called Stonehenge, Neolithic Man and the Cosmos, written by a man that died last year called Professor John North. And it's a huge book, very detailed, and this man makes a very convincing case for our ancestors who built Stonehenge having regarded the stars as their ancestors. You know, it's an absolutely sort of fascinating idea.
Yes.
And a couple of years ago, I wrote to a senior Vatican official who works at, where is it? I can't remember whether it's Arizona or Colorado. The Vatican have an observatory in America. And it just occurred to me that, you know, we know that the people who used Stonehenge or built Stonehenge or who used it were astronomer priests who were fascinated by the stars. I don't think there can be any real doubt about that. So I approached a modern astronomer priest, and I just asked him, very simply, because he was a very educated man, if he thought that the people who use Stonehenge would have considered that there was life in the heavens, extraterrestrial life, purely in the sense of a life not of this earth. And someone else put it very well about a belief in sky people, that the stars may have been dead ancestors, or that there may have been living creatures in the sky, whether we regard them as aliens or whether our ancestors would regard them as gods or not. And I was very pleased indeed, because my site is an unusual one. I look into, I try to cover all the archaeological aspects of Stonehenge, and I'm invited along to the digs myself. So I'm on rock solid ground there. I follow all the work the archaeologists do, but I also pursue my own ideas. And yes, this Vatican official said that he was as certain as he could be that the people at the time of Stonehenge would have regarded the stars as having some kind of life in them.
Yes.
I mean, we know that many cultures have regarded the moon as a physical place. It's a land of the dead and such like. So that's what I try to do. I always try to put myself in the physical position of the men and women who use Stonehenge, because they were just like you and me, just as clever as you and me, of different ages, genders and such like. But it's so hard to get past this idea of cavemen with clubs.
Yeah, of course.
That most people perpetuate.
Well, of course. I mean, again, the mystery of the site in itself, the fact that how it was built and how the stones were moved, that's an ever-present enigma there. Or do you have any other theories in regards to that?
Again, that's another fascinating aspect of it, because a lot of people seem to take it for granted that they were dragged along and such like, but no one has yet done it properly. I mean, these days we're constrained by all sorts of health and safety laws that prevent you reconstructing what happens, but the Sarsen stones were absolutely massive, and especially if you stand up against even one of the smallest ones, the thought of you and me and 100 of our friends dragging it across just one field, you'd virtually give up, because they're just huge. But these people not only did that, but it was but no known structure in Britain before had dressed stone. They were all just rough stones that might have had a little bit knocked off them or something like that. But the ones at Stonehenge were uprights, and they had this interlocking circle of lintels there. And it's just astonishing. It's even if you don't think of what it was used for, these stones are so huge, and they're in a circle, they're carved, they're interlinked, and they've got joints that fit onto the uprights as well. And it's built on the side of a hill, and by rights, the level surface of the top of the lintels should drop by 15 inches. But these people made it level. And I just find it staggering. No one would ever notice in something of that size if one side was 15 inches lower than the other. And I can't imagine I would ever notice, but they got it right. They got it exactly level. So why bother? Why on earth go to such enormous efforts to do something like that?
Do you think, again, we can say the same about other megalithic sites around the world. Why build the pyramids? Why build all these temples and so forth? And do you think it's simply a religious kind of more philosophical approach to the reasons, or do you think it has to do with the present idea that it's simply an astrological observation site as well, or what do you think?
Well, Stonehenge is the place that fascinates me most, and it's the one I can speak with some authority on. And the thing that keeps coming to mind is that if the people, as they did, went to such trouble to build this place, then I can't help thinking that they expected some immediate reward for it. I don't know what form that reward would have taken. There are all manners of rewards. I mean, you could say that as some people do, we're going to build this wonderful thing and then people will come from far and wide to gaze at it. But I don't think that's why they did it. And you could say, well, you know, we've built it so we can observe the stars, but you can observe the stars standing in a field. You don't have to build something this massive. It's just the sheer amount of work and thought that went into it. I think that these people were rewarded from it. They rewarded for it in some way. I think that something to do with what they did at the place, and even today, we have these faint remnants. You know, 4,500 years later, there are still people that see, that say that the place draws down starlight. And I've seen, you know, dead creatures there for myself. And apart from that, Stonehenge gets 1 million visitors every year that just circle around the place and gaze at it in wonderment. So what I would say is that even 4,500 years later, the place isn't inert. It's not just a block of stone. It's, you know, it's alive in some way.
Yeah.
And if that survived 4,500 years later with huge motorways next to it and such like, then try to imagine what it was like when it was originally built.
Well, that's good that you bring up that point, because I wanted to ask you about that, how you think it actually looked when it was complete and all the stones had fallen or been taken off for various reasons. How did it look like, do you think?
Well, one of the really strange things, well, one of the many strange things about Stonehenge is the southern entrance. If you look on all the official diagrams of Stonehenge, everyone thinks that there was a full circle there. But it's almost certain that there wasn't, because one of the uprights to the south is called Stone 11. And there are pictures of it on my site. You can find it on the internet as well. And it's much smaller than its neighbors, and it's leaning out at an angle. It's called Stone 11 because that's its configuration. And it was never as big as its neighbors. It just wasn't. So it couldn't possibly have supported one of the stone lintels, which means that it's extremely unlikely that there was a full circle, interlocking circle there. But the odd thing is that Stone 11 is opposite the southern causeway in the ditch. And we know from excavations that, you know, it was built in around 3000 BC, and then we know that at some point later there was a timber phase there. And people have found remains of a passageway, which may have been a covered passageway, leading into Stonehenge during the timber phase. And then, almost 1,000 years later, you find exactly the same thing echoed with this smaller stone. There was something about the southern entrance to Stonehenge, or it may have been the southern exit to Stonehenge.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep thinking of it a bit like the Sword of Damocles. You know, there was no... It's very unlikely that there was a stone lintel there. Perhaps this smaller stone may have supported an ornate wooden carving. But again, when people did the excavations in the early part of the last century and they dug up this southern causeway, one of the most amazing things about it was that on either side of this causeway, they found cattle bones. They were jaw bones. But there were almost certainly others that the archaeologists at the time didn't bother recording. And we know from carbon dating that these skulls and jaw bones were already as much as 500 years old when they were carefully placed in the bottom of the ditch.
Really? No.
Oh, yes. So whatever these things were, they had been kept above ground and revered, venerated, or perhaps even feared. And then at the earliest part of Stonehenge, they were laid at this very important entrance to the place. But they were 500 years older than the monument was. So there's something absolutely exceptional just about the southern part to it. And I would just say to your listeners that if anyone's seriously interested in the place, you know, look it up on the internet. The Wikipedia entry is excellent. And where at first you might think you cannot possibly make head or tail of it, if you just apply yourself to it and look at all the details and all the clues that there are there, it's not just a few blocks of stone. It's the most mesmerizing thing I've ever seen, and I just can't imagine losing interest in it till the day I die.
Can you say about the heel, what is known as the heel stone, and the relationship with the circle as well?
Well, the heel stone, it's this massive block of sarsen that lies to the northeast of Stonehenge, and again, there's a huge amount that we can say about that. The sun rises almost exactly over it on midsummer solstice. And there was a ditch dug around it as well. It's a colossal stone, but we know from excavations that there were others close by that may have formed, a covered opening of three uprights. And we know that there are other stones further down the avenue. It's difficult talking about it. It'll be so much easier if you look on the internet, look at diagrams and such like. It brings it to life. But there's hardly a single stone at Stonehenge that doesn't have something truly fascinating about it, in itself. I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
No, go on.
Well, I'm looking around here, and I will indeed add a few diagrams for our listeners on our website as well, so they can look at some of this while we talk here. But there's another one called, and it seems to be kind of a misnamed or whatever, it's called the Slaughter Stone. Do you know what that is?
Yes. I mean, it was called the Slaughter Stone in Victorian times because it had a reddish coloring on top, which probably came from iron oxide. So the people in Victorian times put two and two together, assumed that it had always lain flat, and assumed that the red on top was something to do with the blood from sacrifices. But we know that the Slaughter Stone once stood upright, and it had at least one companion that stood alongside it. I mean, a lot of, even at the site itself, new things are still coming to light. So it's just hard to talk about even one stone because each one of them has so much history to it. I mean, what I was going to say earlier was that in 1953, I think it was, there was this Professor Atkinson that dug at the place, and he claimed to have spotted an engraving of what looked like a Mycenaean dagger and an axe on
yes,
the upright.
Yes,
there.
I heard about that.
Although my research tells me that a schoolboy saw it first and, that he claimed it for himself. But, I mean, Stonehenge had a huge amount of visitors before then. I mean, it had people visiting it as a curiosity for hundreds of years. People like William Blake and such like have had a really good look around. But this engraving had gone unnoticed for something like 3,000 years, and it's staring everyone in the face.
Yeah.
But back in 2002, a company called Archaeoptics did a laser scan on this stone, and it involved this is all up on the internet as well, the laser scanning of Stonehenge, and it's on my site as well. And they shone laser beams at an oblique angle across this engraving, and they immediately found seven or eight more that no one had seen. And so that's just one small part of Stonehenge, but there's a huge surface area to all the other stones. I mean, we know that there's graffiti there and such like, and we know that there's an engraving, a strange engraving. It's rectangular with a blob on the top, and some people think it might be of an Earth mother goddess or whatever.
Yeah.
But still, it's one of the most studied sites on Earth. And there's this huge surface area that nobody has ever studied. I mean, God only knows what else might be there.
Yeah, exactly. But what's your theories about this? Are they genuine? And why are people discovering them so late in the process if so many people visit them each year? Do we not look properly when we actually go there? Or what do you think?
Well, that's just it. I mean, Stonehenge doesn't compare to the pyramids in terms of size. I mean, it's a huge structure, but it's nowhere near as big as some on Earth. And, literally millions of people over the centuries have had a really close look at Stonehenge, but still, people don't notice what's right in front of their eyes.
Hmm.
I mean, one other thing, it's on is on my site is when I've been looking at Stonehenge, it's nothing to do with ley lines or anything like that, but I noticed that there was a series of features going to the northwest of Stonehenge. I can't say whether they're connected or not, but I've got a map of them on my site. And just starting from the centre of Stonehenge, the original orientation of the blue line, the blue stones look as if it pointed to the northwest.
Mm-hmm.
There are some pits in the car park there that were dug in the Mesolithic era, in something like 8,500 BC. There's the northwest, and there are lots of other features there. And I can't explain what it is, but you cannot deny that there's a rough alignment of very notable features going to the northwest of Stonehenge. I've mm-hmm. called it TANIS. It's my daughter's name, but TANIS is an acronym for the Avenue Northwest into the Hills. And just by coincidence, they're building a new visitor center to the northwest of Stonehenge. So there's a lot of excavation due to take place there. And I wouldn't be remotely surprised if some very interesting new feature came to light as a result.
Interesting. Reading an article a little bit here, parts of it in regards to Stonehenge and what they think was the people of the time, what they call the king of Stonehenge, and they found a really interesting kind of diamond-shaped or square, depending on how you turn it, of course, a golden ornament.
A lozenge, yes. That was the bush barrow warrior that was excavated in the last century. I mean, again, this is just such a crying shame because this man was found with these wonderful gold implements on him. Tiny gold pins in his dagger and such like. But we know that the barrows around Stonehenge, it's heartbreaking. You know, about 200 years ago, the antiquarian movement started with country vicars and such like hiring laborers for the day, just digging into these funeral mounds and throwing away all the pottery and the bones and just looking for gold. And the most heartbreaking of the lot, again, I've documented this in my book because I've mentioned Stonehenge at some length in my book about the missing years of Jesus, is that one of the antiquarians said that, he put it in heartrending terms, eternally to be lamented is the loss of a tablet of tin. And he describes how in the reign of Henry VIII, which was in the 16th century, someone found a tablet of tin at Stonehenge. We don't know how big it was or anything like that, but we know that it was covered in writing. And the people of the time took it to schoolmasters and professors and such like, and no one knew, no one could understand the writing. Some people thought it was Phoenician, some people thought it was Greek, but they couldn't understand it. And it had been deliberately buried there, and it's been lost. And it's just enough to make you weep. But even worse than that is that labourers who were ploughing in the area to the south of Stonehenge apparently found even more of these tablets with inscriptions on them, and they sold them as pewter to make cauldrons and buckets and such like.
Oh, no.
It doesn't bear thinking of, but the strange thing is about the tablet that fascinated everyone at the time, we still have things coming to light these days from Leonardo da Vinci and such like. 600 years later, people are still finding lost works of his.
Yeah.
So it's not out of the question. It might happen tomorrow. It might not happen for 200 years. But this tablet of tin with these inscriptions from Stonehenge, it might be in someone's attic.
Oh, lying around, you mean? Now, that's right. Let's indulge that idea for a little while. What do you think that those could contain in regards to information?
Well, what interested me most about it, I mean, because we don't know what the writing was, although we know that one person thought it might have been Phoenician, but it was a tablet of tin and it had been deliberately buried at Stonehenge. Now, I wasn't the first person, because English Heritage sell a book with this information is at Stonehenge, to suggest that because all the legends of Jesus in the West Country are so credible and rock solid and such like, what people don't realize is that Stonehenge is just about 30 miles away, abs- no distance from a number of places where Jesus is supposed to have spent 18 years of his life. And Joseph of Arimathea was intimately connected with the tin trade. So when I hear of an inscribed tablet of tin found at Stonehenge that might have had Phoenician writing on it, then that is my best guess.
The most famous
person from antiquity who's connected with tin, and he was in the area, apparently living just 30 miles away. So that's my guess. Something to do with Joseph of Arimathea and something to do with Jesus, because it's the best we can go on.
What about if we look at some of the other sites around the world that have similar features? I mean, a while back here, apparently there was a Stonehenge discovered beneath the waters of a Michigan lake, or a lake in Lake Michigan, and there's even been what they call a tropical Stonehenge found in the Brazilian Amazon. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's your take on that? Do you think they're connected in any way, or how do we look at that?
Well, it's interesting, because just a little while ago on my site, I was sent some fantastic information by a Russian archaeologist who's working in some forests in the Ukraine. And she sent me photographs of what people call the Ukrainian Stonehenge.
Mm-hmm.
And the name Stonehenge is so famous that it's applied to virtually anything interesting of rock all around the world. I mean, I suppose the defining characteristic of Stonehenge is that it had proper masonry there. The lintels on the top of the uprights were properly dressed to interlink and go in a circle. But there's nothing else like it in the world. So when you say the Amazonian Stonehenge, people, I think, use that expression in terms of it being something amazing from ancient times, rather than having any direct link with Stonehenge. It's just the best yardstick they can provide.
Yeah.
The Ukrainian Stonehenge, it looks like a natural feature, but again, it was absolutely fascinating being told the stories connected to it, because again, they were connected with the devil and connected with millstones and connected with stories of a holy traveler and such like. So I can't imagine that these places are linked in any meaningful way, but they're meaningful in as much as they make the rest of us sit up and take notice.
Well, that's right, exactly, because... go ahead.
Yeah, and gaze at them in awe. I mean, I still do that when I go to Stonehenge. I mean, even, you know, talking to you for an hour, I can't really do more than, scratch the surface of it. But, you know, it's in my book and on my site as well. But I still go to Stonehenge, and I still stand there with my jaw dropping. Mm. Even after all these years and after all these hundreds of visits, it just astonishes me that 5,000 years ago, my ancestors went to a staggering amount of effort to build this thing, and I think they expected rewards from it. And you mentioned earlier about kings and star worship. I mean, there's so much there. If you take the patience and trouble to read up about it, then little parts fall into place. It's just wonderful just being able to have even if you have a tiny glimpse into the past, it's better than curtain of nothingness.
Well, that's true, absolutely. It is a really, really interesting site. And, you know, if we finish on this note, two things actually I want to ask you. One thing is if you've been there either at the winter or summer solstice, and also, of course, if there's anything else, major thing that you think is worth mentioning that we have neglected to talk about regarding the site and the monument.
Well, when I lived on Salisbury Plain, I went to every open access at the place. I was people had been banned from going there for a long time, but in 1998, I was one of the first people allowed in there. There were just 100 of us that were allowed there. And so it was very special to be there when so few others have. And I've had some private access to the place as well. And yet another astonishing aspect of the place is it looks impressive enough from outside, as you start to walk into it, it's a bit like Doctor Who's TARDIS. It just suddenly changes. It's impressive enough anyway, but once you get inside, nobody can help but feel overwhelmed just by the sheer massiveness of the stones that are there. As for the summer solstice, you know, I took my children there every year and I took them into the centre of it, and it was very exciting for them, and a lot of people love going there. I wouldn't knock it, but I don't think that that's ever what really happened in prehistory. As for any specific function that Stonehenge served, I've written about this. I believe that there was a sentinel at Stonehenge. I believe that it was an ongoing ritual. You know, an archaeologist and a journalist from Der Spiegel magazine questioned me at great length about this and wrote a piece that's up on my site as well. But I'm hoping soon to put up something fairly major. I've mentioned it in my book, but I have some photographs that haven't seen the light of day yet. And I think that one of the things that Stonehenge was the prototype of the labyrinth, of the Cretan labyrinth.
Mm-hmm. Really? Oh, that's interesting.
I think that an almost identical ritual took place there. But more to the point, Henrik, I think I can, even if I can't prove it, I can provide some evidence to suggest it was the case.
That's really interesting. And you will, are you in the process of releasing some of this information on your website, you said?
Yes, I'll let you know when I do. It's just on my site. I write up, you know, long considered pieces rather than just short pieces, just because I just try to do justice to it. May not be the greatest writer, but I want to have a big amount of text and information there that delivers the whole case. And so hopefully in the next month or two, I'll be able to put up these photographs that haven't been seen before, along with some graphics and such like, and people can read more about it for themselves. I'm sure that a lot of things took place there, but I think that at its heart, that's what Stonehenge was. It was the forerunner of the labyrinth, with an almost identical ritual that took place to the Cretan one.
Great.
It's all very well for me to say that, but I've got to make the case for it. But there's a lot there.
Absolutely. Okay, that's very interesting. Let's keep our eyes then on your website, of course, eternalidol.com. And but just roughly and shortly here, how much approximately do you spend on Stonehenge in your book, The Missing Years of Jesus? Do you spend a few chapters or one on it?
It's getting on for a third of the book.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because I think that Jesus spent as many as 18 years in Britain. The book's 90,000 words. And if he spent almost 18 years just 30 miles away from the most famous monument on Earth, and we know that people have been coming from as far away as continental Europe in 2300 BC to see the place. We know that because we physically dug them up. So apart from anything else, I think that Jesus spent a long time in the west of England. And for whatever reason he went, even if it was just simple curiosity, I'm sure he visited the place. And then when you start looking at things like tablets of tin being found there with Phoenician on it, then it makes me think a bit more. But there's such a huge amount to go into if you can take the time and trouble to look into it. There's more there than just some earthworks and some old stones.
Okay, there we have it. Let's round things up then for this time, Dennis. The websites again are themissingyearsofjesus.com. That's more information about the book, of course, and then regarding other things, archaeology and primarily Stonehenge and new discoveries and so forth. Keep an eye on eternalidol.com. Thank you very much for joining us, Dennis. I really enjoyed it, and keep up the good work, okay?
Well, it's my pleasure. It's a real honor to be invited onto your station, Henrik, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you, so thank you very much indeed for that.
Thank you for joining us here in our member section. Look in our radio archive for upcoming guests on the radio show, and use our entry form in the member section if you want to suggest a guest or a topic. We do want to hear from you. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. We will be back soon with more radio and video material. Until then, take good care. We will talk more soon.